From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage.
Thousands of people flocked to the Black Hills for the 4th of July fireworks. As cities across the nation are balancing reopening strategies with public health recommendations, we spent the week checking in with cities in South Dakota. Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender is asking the public to wear masks, especially in crowded places where distancing cannot be controlled. Here's Lori's conversation with Mayor Allender.
Mayor Steve Allender joins us today. Mayor Allender, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a really challenging time to be in leadership and public service as the facts and the data continue to change and we continue to learn more about the virus. Take me back, 100 days or so when this pandemic first started and we started seeing our first confirmed cases in the state. What do you wish you knew back then that you know now about how things are going to unfold?
Well, that's a big question. I wish we could have had more time, frankly, watching other countries as this developed in China. I wish it would have spread at a slower rate so that we could have learned more about the virus as a nation, as a medical community, because the early decisions in mitigating the virus were made on some international data that was really extreme in some cases when you're watching in the rural areas of Italy and Spain and China and then Iran. And then now we see some early cases in Washington State. And so we have to make some policy decisions based on that early data. And it was really was one of the pieces of the puzzle of how to confuse everyone in 2020. Immediately this became a political debate. There was a lot of room for judgment and disagreement. So I wish there could have been more knowledge of the virus behavior. Of course, I think that looking back, it was impossible, but that's what I wish anyway, that we could have made some better informed decisions back then.
Yeah. You mentioned sort of the politics of this, and you've also been talking about how people really should wear masks, and somehow masks have become, almost a political litmus test in one way or another. So putting politics aside, why do masks matter for people visiting Rapid City, for people who live there? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, a mask or a face covering is essential in an environment where you can't control the distance between yourself and others. And I would say that is the shopping center, the airport, places where you may be having to walk directly behind someone who's coughing. The key is I think everyone has to wear them for it to be effective, because these are not medical grade masks to filter out virus particles before they get into your lungs. These are face coverings basically that will catch some of the respiratory droplets when they come from your mouth and nose so that it doesn't get into someone else's airspace. So I think it is it's a bit of a common courtesy, but I think it's also an important mitigation factor. There's been no evidence to the contrary that masks are harmful or do absolutely no good. We have to trust somebody. When politics comes, then you know what side you're on. But this is a medical issue, and we should be trusting the medical community who are advising us that, masks in indoor or crowded places are essential.
There was a time when there were very few cases in Pennington County, almost to the point where people were wondering if there were more cases and just not enough testing, or what was going to happen, kind of holding their breath to find out what the future would be what the future would hold. And I'm wondering how you see the situation now that it's more like, yes, this is a part of our lives. Yes, we have to figure out what to do about job loss and the loss of lives from a virus. How are you making some of these decisions about what to mandate, what to ask for, what to suggest, what's a non-starter, what we absolutely must do? Can you give me that sort of big picture when you're sitting and really, if you get any just thinking time, how are you making some of those decisions with your team?
Well, starting out very early in the life of the pandemic, in South Dakota, Rapid City was the first city to impose regulations, public health regulations, and we were the last city to remove them. And, there's lots of opportunity. In fact, I said that early on, there'll be plenty of time for finger pointing after this is over, and that certainly is true. We went early. We imposed early. It was based largely on fear, on partially accurate information, but it was necessary. And after just a month of that, given the stress of the pandemic and the job loss and the economic downturn, the political arguments, all of these things really go toward demoralizing the people. And at some point, it became evident that that little sentence in the Declaration of Independence that talks about we get the authority to govern from the people, only from the people that we're governing, and no more. That's really become evident. So we sensed widespread fatigue, and I think stress is another word for that, but widespread fatigue from all of the things happening at the time, including government regulations. There's no doubt you put a mask on for the first time and it's hot and you're in a crowded place and you're worried about staying 6 feet away and got all these things on your mind, you can set off a good dose of anxiety. And that all, regardless of the source, what it all spelled was the people were slowly giving up their faith or their permission for the government to control those aspects of their life. So we rescinded the laws, the regulations, and we turned them into recommendations. Now, there's going to be lots of time to criticize that. And some states are now going backwards and reimposing safety measures. I don't know if that's going to happen here in South Dakota or in Pennington County. I think we're probably on track to have the longest duration peak of anyone. You know, it's been very slow and steady, a slow and steady ascent to what is going to be our peak. But I think you're going to have to stand back from the chart quite a ways to see exactly when our peak was, because it's so gradual. That's the difference, I think, between us and Florida or New York or New Jersey.
Yeah. Let's talk about this idea of the consent of a people to be governed, because that was central to Governor Noem's remarks and President Trump's remarks on the 4th of July, this idea that the founding fathers, fundamental American notion that the rights are endowed by a creator and that people consent to be governed by people in charge. Mm-hmm. And I have two questions about that, and one is going to clearly be, we'll get to in a minute, which is the impact of the crowd and the way that the crowd was set up without masks, for example. But in the when we get back to this idea of consent, people were, exhausted from government restrictions. They're also going to be exhausted from a death toll. They want to be safe. They want to go somewhere and feel like they are safe. Is there a third option? And specifically, I'm wondering about community screening and just the original, you know, back 100 days ago when we were talking about comprehensive testing and, you know, randomized testing. Are there ways to set up a community where there is enough testing and antibody testing and contact tracing to sort of say, this is what we know about the virus in this community? Have we gotten there yet? Is there a third option that we could be looking at that has to do with fundamental, rigorous community screening?
Well, I certainly wish there was. I think the fact of the matter, we don't have anywhere near the appropriate volume of test supplies or capacity to even experiment with one community in America to find out exactly what's going on out there in all age groups. This is mass testing is largely a theory. And when you get your daily tests back and 30% of all your tests are positive, that's evidence that you're testing only symptomatic people and, you know, that there's no real regard for accurate tracking of the virus. So that's one of the most disappointing things looking back in the early stages of the pandemic. You know, our generation's having to endure a pandemic. This is a big deal. And immediately we were informed that there is a national supply shortage for testing materials and testing capacity. That is a huge letdown. And that remains today, although our testing capacity is greater today. I don't think our testing supplies are much greater. Sturgis just announced a plan to do mass testing following the Sturgis motorcycle rally. What they mean by that is they're going to do an additional 1,300 tests in Sturgis after the rally is over. 1,300. To me, that's not necessarily mass testing. That is a larger testing sample than normal, but we don't have mass testing in this country, and it doesn't appear that we're ever going to have.
Disappointing. Go ahead. What was that?
It's concerning and disappointing that we're in that position.
Are you hearing that frustration from your constituents at all, the frustration that we shouldn't feel like we have to choose between going to work and getting sick and that testing is still something they want in a much more robust way?
Oh, absolutely. That's probably been the first consistent complaint from citizens, and it remains today. Now, some of the expectations are outrageous, such as they want a test a week for every person in America, regardless of symptoms. Certainly, we can't have 330 million tests weekly, but you know, for the most part, they're very reasonable concerns. And so for me, it spells two things. That it articulates the actual situation where we have less testing than desired, but also it articulates a lack of confidence or communication or both in public health officials. And so without confidence, people don't act rationally. They will go into survival mode, and they will do and say things based on that fear. So we've seen a lot of that over the last several months.
Let's talk about the 4th of July gathering, because there were very few masks that were worn, although we were told they were available, and there was a big crowd, many of them from other states. What do you think happens next in Rapid City? Is it a wait and see approach? Do you sort of see the impact on the economy? Did it get a little boost from sales tax numbers? Or, you know, how do you kind of look at that event and then look at the next 2 weeks and say, okay, what's the impact?
Well, within 2 weeks, I'll be able to tell you if there was a local impact or not. One of the things we do not have the capacity for, or the ability or willingness for, is to report out-of-state positive tests from your community. So any visitors that we had here in South Dakota who were tested and perhaps test positive, our citizens and our government officials throughout the state will never know these numbers, because they're reported on the county of residence rather than where the test occurred. So we'll have to rely on simply the number of local individuals who may have become ill and tested positive. So in a couple of weeks, we should have all the data in from 4th of July. Then we'll be in the middle of the motorcycle rally, and a couple of weeks after that, then we'll know. So this is absolutely a wait and see scenario, you know, and to give the event the benefit of the doubt, it was an outdoor event, and the people there had a choice to wear a mask or not. Of course, it was 90 plus degrees out, and anyone who's worn a mask knows that it's going to be very uncomfortable. And so we had a bunch of, you know, grown adults making informed decisions about what to do. And the question is, who will pay for that? Will it just be those users, those individuals who made that decision, or will it be our hospital systems and the other potentially innocent victims who are needing care and can't get it? That's been the real concern from the beginning, is protecting our hospital capacity. And frankly, at this point, it does not appear that our hospital capacity is at risk. Of course, we can't predict what's going to happen in a couple of weeks or a couple months either.
Right.
So if what I said and what I've been saying sounds like making a lot of guesses and learning as we go, that's exactly what's happening.
Next up, we hear from Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken.
Mayor Tenhaken, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing all right. First of all, as a resident of the city of Sioux Falls, hey, those fireworks were all right.
Yes. Wasn't it nice we had them? It was awesome. And I'm assuming you're not talking about the ones you shot off in your own driveway, right?
No, but... You know, you didn't need me to obey that rule, because plenty of people were not obeying that rule. Sorry.
I know.
I hate to break it to you.
We hear that one every year, and every year we deal with it. People are getting a little bit better, but that's a tough one to enforce for sure.
Yeah. You must have heard people, I mean, talk about the decision to have those fireworks, because there was no event, no speeches, no music. You just could head out to, you know, that T. Daddy Sanford part of town with the Premier Center, I mean, and Elmwood Golf Course and by the Holiday Inn, and just mm-hmm. find a spot. For a while, we kind of mm-hmm. cruised the loop a little bit on Russell and sort of went back and forth, which was sort of fun. And how did you make that decision and realize that maybe the people of the city sort of needed that?
Well, you said it right there. People needed that. There's just some normalcy that people need to have on some certain things. And fireworks on the 4th of July is one of those. And so when it looked like it wasn't going to happen initially, I got to give a lot of credit to a gentleman named John Small in our community who kind of stepped up to help organize it. And you know, we then came alongside him to make sure it happened. But there's just a desire right now in the community. And then we're going to talk about COVID a little bit right now as well, that people are so hungry for signs of the way things used to be, whether that's just being able to go out for a ride and interact with friends and go to fireworks and maybe grab an ice cream. I mean, there's a desire for that in South Dakota. It's making it increasingly challenging, though, for people to still realize there's a virus that's still with us and present, and that we're not entirely in a normal state. We still have some things we have to abide by, some things we have to still do differently. But I am glad that there is some things that are returning to normal, like fireworks on the 4th of July, for instance.
Yeah. Let's talk about sort of dealing with the pandemic and the economy and, you know, professional bull riders coming to town. There's events. People want to do things. It has to make you sort of nervous and yet also encouraged. How do you deal with, you know, the leadership aspect of talking to Sioux Falls citizens and saying, I know you want to do this, but you really got to think twice about how you do it?
Mm-hmm. You know, there is increasingly two camps, and the chasm between the camps is widening. And you know, the one camp is be safe, stay at home, don't go out. And the other camp is like, hey, we're back, baby. And events are back and everything's normal. And the reality is we're kind of in the middle there. And we're in the middle in South Dakota, probably much more so than some of the other states. And I just had a meeting with the folks from Sanford Health, and they're doing the Sanford International Golf Tournament, and that's going to be in September, and talked about the precautions that they'll need to take with spectators and with things like that. And the PBR here in Sioux Falls is some of the same protocols. They said, listen, we're going to make this a very safe event. We have entirely retooled not only the fan experience in the Premier Center itself, but also the way that the athletes, the bull riders, all the staff are having to interact with one another, interact with the fans. It's a different day right now to have an event like this. And quite honestly, it's very expensive. It's very costly because you don't sell as many tickets and your cost of putting on an event really increases. And so my message to people has been this. You know, you need to do what you feel comfortable doing. And if you feel safe getting out there, spending some dollars, going to restaurants, going to the PBR, you need to do that. But you also need to know that that's a personal responsibility and a personal accountability issue for you and your family. Now, these restaurants, events, they are taking incredible measures to ensure a safe experience for you. But if you don't feel safe doing that, you don't feel comfortable doing that, don't do that. And we've increasingly seen that there's people who are comfortable with that. There's people who are not. And we're trying to make sure that people feel comfortable, whatever decision they make, if they want to stay home or if they want to go out, they can do that.
Is there an in-between of people who want, or you know, that we're encouraging courtesy to, and just, you know, yes, get out and do it if you're not concerned, but, you know, wear that mask and be courteous to the other people because the consequences of your actions impact more than just you and your family.
Yeah, great example. I had a lunch meeting yesterday at a larger and more popular Sioux Falls restaurant, and they have reduced their seating capacity to half, even though they don't have to. And they have some regulars who are very comfortable going to that restaurant. And some of these regulars are older folks because of those steps that the restaurant has taken. Their tables are very far distance apart. All the staff wears masks. They've created a very safe environment for people to dine out. And because of that, the patrons are visiting their venue. You have other restaurants that aren't taking those measures, and people are patronizing that because they don't care. They quite honestly don't care. And I don't mean that in like a selfish way, but there's just different levels of concern that people have on the spectrum. And our role as elected officials is to say, okay, how do we ensure that the economy keeps working, that people who do have concerns still can conduct business in the city safely, and that these businesses are also abiding by some of the protocols that they need to enact to ensure a safe experience for their customer. It's just a very delicate balance right now. But the good news is the fact that South Dakota overall has seen low hospitalization rates and low mortality rates from COVID. And when I was meeting with the folks I mentioned earlier about the golf event, I said, listen, if we could put a bubble over Sioux Falls and not have anyone watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or whatever it is, and just look at what's happening here, they get a very different story. But they're seeing these tremendous outbreaks in places like Florida and Texas and California and assuming we're next. Well, we have 850,000 people in this entire state. Okay, we have a fraction of the population base, and we're social distance in a lot of ways by default, just in how we live here. And so that in and of itself has given us a tremendous advantage, and why we haven't seen yet, you know, the spread and the surge, other than one specific outbreak we had early on as a result of COVID.
Is it possible for a city the size of Sioux Falls to really enact a robust community screening program that maybe other cities can't do? I know you can't put that bubble over us, but I think a lot of people are saying, well, we could be doing a lot more if we had, comprehensive public health antibody, results, if we had community screening of random, is our testing and our screening robust enough, or do we have room to grow in that area so that our economy can benefit from it?
Well, I think, that's a great question, Lori. And, right now we're testing around 2,000 people a week in Sioux Falls. I just got fresh numbers. Last week we tested around 1,700 people in the Sioux Falls MSA, and we had about a 7% positivity rate. So you can do the math. It's a little under 100 people who tested positive in the MSA. So we continue to hang around this 5, 6, 7% positivity rate. So the thought is if you test more, you maybe have more positive cases. But our positivity rate has been very much pretty flat around that 5-6% mark. And so until we see a dramatic spike or increase in that, that's the assumption we continue to go off, is that we have this, 5-7% positivity rate in our market, of which only a fraction of those who do test positive need enhanced care. And we have today right around 20 people between Sanford and Avera Health in Sioux Falls that are inpatients for COVID-related illnesses, when at one point we were projecting the need for potentially 500-600 inpatients at this time. So from that aspect, you can see how this has been so hard to just legislate through and to lead through, because the projections have been so wildly varying, and the hospitalization rate, at one point we were talking that it'd be closer to 25%. Well, now we're dealing more with 5%. The mortality rate from the virus has been way lower than we anticipated. That's obviously certainly not to minimize any loss of life that's happened from COVID, because it's all tragic, of course, but it's not nearly what we anticipated. And that's what's caused some of the shifts we've seen in policy, where things are opening. We are encouraging people to get out there and support some of these businesses that have taken safe practices, because we feel comfortable based on the numbers we've seen.
Let's talk a little bit about capital spending and the plan that you had to lay out, which is somewhat less than the plan that you laid out next year. Tell us a little bit about some of the highlights of that. What's important during this time as we look at an economic catastrophe nationwide, really? What's it look like in Sioux Falls?
Well, we have not been immune to the revenue shortfall that a lot of states and cities have experienced. I will say this, we go into COVID in a strong financial position in the city, in that, for instance, our debt per capita in Sioux Falls is right around $1,750 per resident. Picking on Fargo, for instance, theirs is north of $7,000 per resident. So we go into this in a strong financial position. That being said, even when we have projects we want to do, and we have some big things that we've wanted to do in the city, we still have to respond to the current economic landscape. And that economic landscape right now is showing a sales tax shortage that, last month we were around 15% down year over year. Our entertainment tax closer to 50% down year over year. Those are huge cuts. And so that has forced us as a city to say, what are the critical services that we need to focus on? What do people expect of their city? And they expect infrastructure investments, public safety. They want to feel safe in their community. They want to make sure their water turns on, their toilets flush. And so a lot of our capital budget that we've laid out there's not a lot of shiny things in there. It's a lot of just investments in the core tenets of government to deliver the services. And we don't have a lot of those excess funds for parks and for new pools and some of those amenities that will have to wait given the current environment.
As you look at issues of equity, you've been talking about projects in the Whittier neighborhood to deal with power lines and things like that. Tell us a little bit about why that's important to move forward in projects in neighborhoods all kinds of neighborhoods in the city, but particularly this Whittier neighborhood and focusing there.
Well, the core of the city, the heartbeat of any city, is its downtown. And you show me a city with a dead downtown, and I'll show you a city that's dying a slow death. And so the Whittier neighborhood is blocks away from our downtown. And so too often, I think, when we look at our downtown, we think of, five or six square blocks of an area where we have a lot of our retail. But our downtown expands beyond that. And so we need to continue to look at investments that we're making in infrastructure projects and in housing projects and safety projects that extend to Whittier, extend to Pettigrew Heights and the Cathedral District. All these neighborhoods that surround our downtown, the stronger those can be, the more attractive they can be, the more safe they can be, the stronger our downtown will be, and thus the stronger our economy as a whole will be. Because as I mentioned, the downtown is really, it's the heartbeat of your city.
I also want to talk with you a little bit about policing, and that's kind of a conversation for another time. But I hope that we can have those ongoing conversations. But for right now, a snapshot for today. What's next for you as mayor after the protest? You posted on Facebook and on social media, reach out to my office and let's have a conversation. Are there new conversations? Are you having conversations you hadn't had before that are opening your eyes to a direction that the city maybe needs to consider?
Absolutely, I am. And that's been good for me because you hit it right on the head that there are people that I'm conversing with, that I'm meeting with in this office, who otherwise never would have felt comfortable coming to the mayor's office to talk about a topic. And specifically, I've met with a lot of people of color over the last couple weeks who reached out and said, hey, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with you on policy. I just want you to hear my perspective on this topic and where I come from on this and some ideas I have. And those ideas, some are palatable and some are realistic, some are not. But from that, you start to determine what policy can look like. I think what we're seeing in some aspects across the country is reactive policy to the current environment we're in. And not that those policy decisions are wrong, but when you make them so quickly and you make them emotionally, you have to question whether or not there's staying power to those policy decisions. So what we're doing in Sioux Falls is there are a bevy of conversations and discussions we're having. You're going to see in the capital budget next week that we're going to roll out, operating budget, some investments and some protocols that we're going to ask our city council to invest in as a result of some of the things we've seen over the last 30 to 60 days. And so we're doing our part here, but we also have to realize that Sioux Falls is not Minneapolis, is not Denver, is not Houston. We have done community policing efforts for years and years, from SROs, community resource officers, citizens police academies, mental health resource officer, which I just added to the budget last year. So in a lot of ways, we're ahead of some of our peer cities in the community policing we've done, which is why we've also not seen some of the volatile policing issues that some of these other cities have dealt with, quite honestly, for many, many years.
And we are 5 months from an election, and several South Dakotans are asking for your vote for the South Dakota State Legislature. So it's time to meet some candidates. Adam Jewell is a Libertarian and running for State Senate. He would represent District 5, which is Coddington County.
Adam joins us now on the phone. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you very much for taking the time to have me on.
Tell us a little bit about District 5. What do people need to know about your district?
District 5 is kind of where I've, been born and raised, right here in Watertown. Is really what I want people to know is that there is another option You know, other we've never really had anything other than a Republican candidate out of Watertown or District 5. And, you know, I just want to bring attention that there is another option, you know, in the Libertarian candidacy, which I'm running with. And just it gives another option to District 5, and not only District 5, but to bring something else to peer of someone that has some, you know, socially liberal ideas, but also fiscally conservative. I mean, that's kind of what libertarianism is all about.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a minute. A little bit about the people that you would represent. What is this area like? What are the top industries and some of the top concerns from people that you're hearing from as you campaign?
Here in Watertown, I work in manufacturing. I worked in manufacturing here for over 10 years. And so, I mean, manufacturing is a huge part of what Watertown is. I mean, we have a lot of big name employers here. And one of the big things, obviously, that not only us, but the state and the country and the world's dealing with is, you know, COVID-19 and how the state's dealing with that, how the community's dealing with that. And that's kind of been the hot button issue with, I guess, everything lately. I mean, you're no stranger to it either. And it's, you know, that's where a lot of people's concerns are with, you know, how we're dealing with it and, you know, how the state and local government's going to be dealing with that.
Right. All right. Let's talk about some of your top issues and go back to something you mentioned just a few minutes ago, which is, you know, people need to understand what exactly is a libertarian. So you said a little, you know, socially liberal, fiscally conservative. Say more about what you sort of think is awry with some of the, you know, the Republican or Democratic platforms that you think makes more sense to think about things from a libertarian point of view.
I think when you look at it from you know, outside looking in at the two parties, and yes, South Dakota is mainly Republican heavy, but we do have, you know, a few Democrats in there. But when it comes to libertarianism, it's we really want people just to be able to make their own decisions, and you know, businesses should be able to be ran how they best feel suited and with as little government involvement as possible. I believe South Dakota can be a very prosperous state, and we can lead the nation in a lot of things if we were to have a little bit less government involvement in our day-to-day stuff, you know, between our businesses and just people's personal lives.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your background, your family life, what kind of, what drew you into manufacturing as an industry and as a profession. Tell me a little bit more about you.
Well, if you want to talk about my family, I could talk hours because I have two beautiful little girls, Adrian and Amelia. They're, the oldest one's about 7 here in a month, and the other one just turned 4. I've been married since 2010 to my wife. She's a teacher in Florence, South Dakota, actually. Like I said, my background, I mean, work-wise, has always been in manufacturing. I do have a degree in business that I obtained out of, like, after high school. I did an online program, but I've just worked in numerous positions in manufacturing and different parts of the job I work for now, and I've dabbled in podcasting and social media management, so all of that's kind of brought, you know, introduced me to, I guess in a sense, libertarianism, because, you know, looking around, and I've always wanted to have a voice, and I just never agreed with a lot of the blue ideas or the red ideas. So that's kind of where I found the gold ideas, I guess you could say, of the Libertarian Party.
Yeah. Tell me what kind of future South Dakota you want for Adrian and Amelia. What are some of the things that you'd like them to grow into when they're young adults?
I want them to have as many opportunities in South Dakota as that they could find elsewhere, whether that, you know, whatever profession they want to choose to be into. Like, if you ask my daughters, they want to be dancers and cops and firefighters and doctors all at the same time. So, you know, I mean, in reality, I'd like to see that South Dakota could bring so many types of businesses that maybe you could only find in different areas. You know, there's nothing saying that South Dakota couldn't become, you know, the Silicon Valley of this future, you know, if we brought the right people and the right businesses in and, like, had the right allure for any entrepreneur. So I'd love for my kids to grow up and stay in South Dakota and do whatever they want to do here. And hopefully whatever it is that they're passionate about, they can have a future in that, and that there's a job calling for that right here.
Yeah. You mentioned, government staying out of, people's businesses, staying out of their personal lives. Can you give me an example of something that you thought was misguided legislation from Pierre recently that if you were representing your district that you would have taken a stand against?
One of the things that's been brought up and or a couple things, really, and one of them is on the ballot this year, and that's cannabis use, and that's going to be on the ballot this year. But it's been disappointing that between that and hemp production and hemp utilization has been struck down in Pierre, where I believe that when it comes to, like, say, hemp, that we have the opportunity to be a leader in it in South Dakota, but if we don't start producing and start being able to utilize that, we're missing out on a ton of jobs that could be created, and it gives farmers another option of crops that they could grow. And really the fact that we struck it down, a couple of years ago, it really put South Dakota behind, where as if it's something that a farmer wants to be able to grow, he should be able to do that. And if it's something that a business person wants to open up a hemp processing facility in South Dakota, they should have the right to do that without a bunch of red tape to cross through.
Yeah. And transitioning to that ballot question in 2020, what are your thoughts on sort of the medicinal marijuana or recreational marijuana? Where do you stand on that issue?
The big thing with that is that we've seen in other states across the United States how there has been benefits to it. There's been a lot of benefits. It's decreased, other drug abuse like meth or opioid addiction. It's created revenue for schools and stuff, which I would love to see South Dakota's education programs get some more funding. Like I said, my wife's a teacher. I'd love to see the education get a little bit stronger funding. But it's something that if it's something someone does in the privacy of their own home, or has a legal route to go about it, whether it's a dispensary or a medical prescription, I mean, it doesn't affect anyone else's lives, really, as long as you're doing it responsibly. It's the same as alcohol in the sense if you're responsible about it, it's not a big deal.
Next, Toni Miller. She works in the healthcare field as an RN. She's a Democrat out of District 9, which is Minnehaha County, and she is running for state representative.
Toni Miller, welcome. Thanks for being part of Meet the Candidates.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about District 9. What do we need to know?
Well, it's part of the Northwest Sioux Falls, and then we also go out into Crooks, Humboldt, Hartford, and the Wall Lake area.
All right. Tell me why you are reaching out to voters in that area saying, I want to be your representative. What inspires you to run now?
Well, being in healthcare, my main thing has been for several years is Medicaid expansion. And when I ran last time, I met a lot of people that could have benefited from that. You know, they fell into that odd gap where they didn't make enough money for a subsidy under the ACA, but they were not on that, poverty range where they could get Medicaid expansion. So there's a lot of uninsured folks in South Dakota, especially in the rural areas. So, we know that we have one of the highest rates of uninsured low-income people, rural areas up to 47%. That's a lot. That's a big number.
Right. And when you ran before, that was an issue. When you're running now, that seems to be an even more pertinent issue because of a pandemic. And we watch the hospital cases every day. There are many people who are going to suffer at home and avoid going to the hospital because they can't afford to make that journey. Tell me why this issue that is important to you and others is so urgent now in 2020?
Well, you know, I'd like to see the numbers. I know that the healthcare systems have lost huge revenue from the elective procedures that they had to forego. But I would like to see how many uninsured people were treated in our healthcare systems and how much that's really going to hurt us. Now, I don't know if and when we're going to get those numbers. But again, especially in the rural areas, you know, when people are so far away from any healthcare system or emergency system. So I think that if we could just expand Medicaid, I think that we could get some more outreach and some clinics into the smaller communities too.
When you explain to voters how that is workable in South Dakota, what kind of questions are they asking you, and how, you know, I'm guessing it's going to be, well, how do we pay for that? How do you explain to them that it's doable?
Well, it is. And as you know, many of us already know that it was actually Dugard's plan, and it was revenue neutral. And of course, he had to make it that way because there's no way it would have passed a Republican legislature if it wasn't. And, you know, as South Dakota, I do find it odd as a state that we are not taking those federal dollars, because we have been known to do that. So I don't know why we're leaving that federal money on the table when we could use that to help so many South Dakotans.
Yeah. We know a little bit about your healthcare background. Tell us more about your life, your family, and where you grew up and things like that.
Well, I grew up in Sioux Falls. I've lived here my whole life. I'm married and I have a 13-year-old stepdaughter, and she goes to public school here in Sioux Falls at Edison. And my husband works for Brooks. He pours concrete for a living.
Yeah. As we have navigated this pandemic and the nationwide civil unrest where people are talking about equity and racism, one of the topics that has come up is equity in other areas such as wages and affordable housing. And you say that affordable housing is something else that South Dakotans should be thinking about. Tell us more about that.
Well, I work, you know, I'm a volunteer for St. Vincent de Paul. So I have worked with many with the homeless population and also with so many of our clients that are just on the verge of eviction. You know, luckily between not just working with St. Vincent de Paul, but with community outreach and county welfare, we pull together a lot to help save people from eviction. And I don't know what's going to happen here in Sioux Falls now, since there wasn't really a moratorium, I guess you would call it, to keep people from getting evicted. I don't know how much the One Sioux Falls Fund was able to help, but I'm really worried about that. I'm really, really worried about people being evicted during this crisis, especially if some of them haven't been able to go back to work yet.
Right. Let's talk education, because that was something else that was really drastically impacted by the pandemic, where people had to very quickly pivot to online learning. We're still not sure what that looks like in the fall, but one thing is clear: our expectations for teachers and for schools' ability to function is very, very high. What do you think, if you were elected to represent people in Pierre, you would lean into when it comes to public education?
Well, are you talking about the online learning, or are you talking about like what I was, you know, running on was a pre-K program?
I'm just talking in general, like, you know, for you, what do you think is an important thing to consider for education? The pre-K,
well,
is that,
you know,
yeah.
Well, last time I was really focusing on, you know, universal pre-K, but, you know, the last two sessions, we couldn't even get, well, not me, the Democrats had trouble even getting a task force together, which from what I remember was only going to cost about $13,000. So that seems pretty reasonable to me. And then another part of the education, too, that I think we need to keep looking into is some more needs-based scholarships, because we have a lot of kids that, you know, are leaving our state. You know, they're leaving to go to college elsewhere, or they're just leaving the state when they graduate. So I think that we need to look into more needs-based programs to help. You know, I've been a nurse for 17 years, and I'll just be honest, I'm still paying off my student loans. So right. I don't want that. You know, I don't want that for my stepdaughter, you know, my nieces and nephews. So we need to really start focusing on that, too.
Yeah, our previous guest was libertarian and really talked about public or political parties in the state. You're running as Democrat. How important is it to have a balance in the state legislature from your perspective?
Yes, very, very important. I mean, as you can see, these, just the things that we're talking about right now, Medicaid expansion, education, public education, I would think that that would be pretty bipartisan, but it seems to not be. And so, yes, absolutely, we do need to have much more balanced government in here.
Any final thoughts before we let you go? Tony Miller's from District 9. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, just that I think that we can, that I think most South Dakotans, want a South Dakota that works for everyone, not just Democrats, but, libertarians, independents, Republicans. And so I think that we just need to really look at all of our values, that we want freedom, opportunity, security for all South Dakotans. And I think that we do need to just work together and focus on, making South Dakota a good place to grow up and grow old.
Next, Democrat Timothy Reed. He wants to be in the state Senate to represent District 14, which is Minnehaha County.
Timothy, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
I am sitting here in District 14 broadcasting today. So tell the rest of the state of South Dakota a little bit about this district.
Yeah, absolutely. So District 14 is a small, oddly shaped district that is definitely not any of the shapes that I learned growing up and going to high school in geometry class. We are in the southeastern quadrant of Sioux Falls, roughly Cliff Avenue all the way east over into Highway 11 and then kind of skirting up over to 10th Street as well. But that's generally the borders and areas of the district.
Tell us a little bit about why you're deciding now to run for public office. This is a first for you.
It is a first for me. So I actually grew up between Sioux Falls and Cleveland, Ohio in the Rust Belt. And my family moved us out here, raised us in a really nice school district, the Sioux Falls School District. And I graduated from Roosevelt High School in 2010. And after I left, after graduating high school, I left and moved back to Ohio. I moved to Maryland for a little while, moved to Chicago, Illinois, and just got a good kind of visceral feel for how so many different localities operate compared to the environment that I grew up in Sioux Falls. And I love the sense of community that we have in Sioux Falls and in South Dakota in general. I don't think anybody does it better than the 605. But after coming back to South Dakota in 2017, I just really became disheartened with a lot of the focus that the state legislature seems to have. We've got a lot of real issues from education, healthcare, and just overall improving the economy for South Dakota that are kind of on the back burner while we focus on a lot of hateful or discriminatory legislation that seems to catch a lot of national press but doesn't really do a lot for us locally. So I threw my hat into the race this year.
This is a district that sent Aaron Healy, a Democrat, to the state legislature recently. So it can be done. And she did it by, a lot of door to door knocking and listening to people, introducing herself. Talk to me a little bit about campaigning and really getting out to those different places in the district to, gain that name recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, Erin is a great example, and she's done great things for the district and for South Dakota with her leadership in the last 2 years. So I'm excited to follow in those footsteps, winning this election by knocking on doors and engaging with voters directly. One of the most interesting pieces about that with COVID right now is that it's kind of thrown the entire door knocking process through a loop. So I'm excited to begin doing that here as some of the regulations across the state ease up and we get just a little bit more comfortable with being able to do that. But until then and since then, it's been a lot of voter engagement online, talking to people through different forums, Zoom phone calls, which I know we're all getting exhausted with at this point in time. But talking to a lot of people who are still in the community and asking them to reach out to me directly via email, social media. Again, not the campaign that I was expecting to run when I made the ballot back in March, but, the reality of the world that we're all in right now and experiencing.
Let's talk about some of your top priorities. We know what you sort of would like to see the state legislature stay away from, but what are your priorities that they should head toward? What are those top issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So with things that I think we should stay away from, again, if we're going to be passing a lot of anti-LGBTQ or discriminatory legislation, I think that we would be better versed to maybe propose some actual legislation that's going to maybe protect those communities and empower them in South Dakota, since many of these people, like myself, are homegrown from the 605. You know, we're not an external force, and we're not trying to change the state. We're just trying to make sure that we're represented and equal. Moving on, though, if that's not going to be the plan, we need to be focusing on issues like healthcare and education. You know, South Dakota is one of 33 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And there's a recent report that actually came out from Georgetown University that shows that we have a whopping 47% of low-income adults in rural areas who could benefit greatly from that expansion and coverage. But unfortunately, we just have not taken the action as a state. So they fall into that gap where they don't have the access, especially in rural areas, to not only the facilities sometimes, but even when they do have access to a clinic or an area that can provide services, the question of how that coverage is going to be paid for is kind of left in limbo then. So Medicaid expansion for sure. But moving on, education, as I stated before, you know, I'm a graduate of Roosevelt High School here in Sioux Falls, and I'm very thankful for the amazing education that I got in our public school sector, so I would like to see that strengthened. We definitely have a need for early childhood education and the need to examine just the impacts on how that's going to affect and proactively save us money in the long run, especially as tuition in the state kind of, since I left in 2010, has essentially doubled. So we need to focus on how to make sure that young people have access to affordable education that starts as early as we can, but also to make sure that graduates who are otherwise leaving South Dakota or racking up immense debt to stay in South Dakota and become educated have a solution that's going to allow them to actually join the workforce and stay here so that they can be, you know, affordably positioned to raise a family and send their kids to a great public school, then also knowing that their future is paid for and in their own hands.
South Dakota did not fare so far as poorly as many other states due to the pandemic and the economic collapse that some communities are seeing. But still, it looks like some cuts are going to have to be made, and it seems pretty unlikely that some of those cuts aren't going to affect education. If you were elected to the state legislature, how would you approach some of those appropriations decisions? And what are you looking for as you look at how we're spending our money in a time when we might have to do some trimming?
I think that's a great question, because obviously you have to have money in order to spend it. And I think South Dakota has a knack for, as we recently saw over the 4th of July weekend, of, you know, we find a way to find money regardless of maybe what it's been allocated for, as long as we have an agenda that we need to accomplish and something that we want to see done. And I don't think that any other situation or type of reform that we need to bring to South Dakota, whether it's healthcare or education, is going to be any different. You have a lot of powerful forces in the state, both working in terms of real math, but also dedicated to making sure that the system itself doesn't see a lot of change. Our teachers have been told over and over again that there's going to be taxes levied, that there are going to be raises that they're going to see. And unfortunately, that fails to materialize as well. So the leadership that I would like to bring to peer and that I plan on bringing to peer is going to be focused on not only making sure that we do have a clear-cut, idea of where we can get a source of funding for and how to allocate that money, but also to make sure that those are the issues that we're actually throwing our dollars at. If we're going to be opening up the budget and we're going to be opening up the vaults and spending money in the state of South Dakota, we need to make sure that there's a return on our investment for taxpayers. And taxpayers and educators are unfortunately who seems to get the short end of the stick, in addition to the people who are not able to afford and pay for health care as a result of us also not expanding Medicaid.
Timothy Reed is a Democrat running for state Senate from District 14. Timothy, before we let you go, website you want to direct people to or how they can connect with you? What's the best way to learn more about your campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. So Timothy Reed for SD is my website. You can go there and find a brief synopsis of just my campaign, my platform. If you would like to leave me a message or send me an email, I would love to hear from you to know about just the issues that are important to you in South Dakota. And social media, whether you've got Instagram, Facebook, or want to follow me on Twitter, Timothy Reed SD or Timothy 4SD, you can find me at either of those handles, and I'm looking forward to engaging with everyone.
Hugh Bartels would like your vote this fall to continue representing District 5, Cottington County.
Representative Bartels, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me onto your show.
Tell us a little bit about District 5 and the people there. Who are you, and what does the rest of the state need to know about your district?
Well, District 5 is one of the smaller districts in this state. It's two townships, and it basically is the city of Watertown and the two county townships that surround it. So it's a really small, compact district. And like I said, it's basically the city of Watertown.
All right. Now, you're running unopposed this fall. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, I am. I had a primary election. There was three Republicans running for two seats, and Nancy York and I, the two incumbents, won. And so we don't have a fall race at all. So we're going to be going back to Pierre this year.
So let's make use of our time, Mr. Appropriations Committee member. Tell us a little bit about what we can expect with the state budget and appropriations. What are some of the big decisions that legislators are going to have to think about in the days ahead, directly related to the pandemic?
Well, I think when you look at the pandemic, the things that our Appropriations Committee has been working on all summer, we meet in the interim as well, is we've been following revenue really close, because we think that makes a big difference. We'd love to spend money, it appears, but your previous speaker was talking about spending a lot of money, but you can't spend more money than you bring in. We have to balance our budget every year, and so we've been tracking revenue. And while we're really close to what we projected, we think we're going to be within $4 million of what we projected for FY20 when we close the books here in a few days. For the year ending June 30th, I'm really kind of sitting around waiting to hear that number. I hope it's that close. And that's really a really good projection when you got a $1.8 billion cash flow to only be off $4 million, especially with the pandemic. We've had some areas that have done really well and other areas that have really lagged, like hotels and restaurants are down about 73% in remitting sales tax. And sales tax is about a little over $1 billion of our revenue sources. So it's a vital portion of the revenue money that we spend. We've been tracking that really closely. And the other thing we're tracking is all the federal money that's been coming into the state. I think it's a little bit over $1.8 billion has flowed into South Dakota to governments and in units through various COVID bills. And that's not counting the money that farmers and a lot of other people got, but it's just money that's come out of the COVID bills to governmental units. And we're really trying to track really closely the $1.25 billion that came to the state in that COVID bill, how that's being spent and what we're going to have to do to authorize the expenditure of that money.
Is that money available then during the legislative session still, or you'll be able to make some decisions during the session, or is that an ongoing? Tell me a little bit about how that's structured.
Well, that
timelines.
Money has money has a timeline on it. It has to be spent by December 30th, and it has to be spent and actually utilized by December 30th. You can't sign like a consulting contract for 2 years to help deal with COVID. It has to be fully spent by December 30th. You can buy equipment with it that's COVID-related, but the equipment has to be delivered and used by December 30th. So it's really pretty limited in how it has to be handled.
Is it going to be
Go ahead.
I guess my question is it going to be difficult to maximize on that opportunity in the best possible way?
Well, I think it'll be hard to spend all that $1 billion and make sure $1 billion+ and make sure it's used correctly. And we will keep our finger on that as the process goes along. This is the pool of money that the governor has allocated $200 million that she's going to pass through down to the cities. And I think that was a good effort to help get this money out to where it needs. Now, they have the same rules when it comes to the city. It has to be COVID related. And it has to be spent by December 30th. So the rules keep following that money as we push it to different localities.
So is it possible that we will give money back to the federal government and then still be dipping into state reserves and making cuts to education? Is that a scenario that is in the realm of possibility?
Well, it is, because right now you can't use this money for revenue replacement. And that's one of the issues that we keep talking to our federal legislators about, is that we may need to use this for revenue replacement. Even though our revenue is really close, we think it'll still, some of it will still be affected, you know, going out into the future for maybe 18 to 24 months. It's going to take a while for our tourism industry to come back, and it's going to take a while for our farm economy to level out based from COVID effects. So we think we're a long ways down the road from getting normal revenue flows back to the state.
What is going to be the key?
Could be the possibility.
Yeah. What is the key to restarting the economy right now?
Well, I think it's getting people out and making people, you know, secure in how they go about doing their business, and, you know, getting the flow of agricultural products working. You know, things like that are kind of the key to that. Federal government's pumped a lot of money into the businesses through the PPP loan. They've given the farmers quite a bit of over $1 billion worth of dollars. There's a lot of money out there. We need to utilize it and get the economy going. And people need to spend their money locally. That really makes a huge difference if you spend it locally.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts on the money that was spent from the Future Fund to support the fireworks display on the 4th of July? Can you help put that into context for us?
Well, the Futures Fund is kind of a wide-open fund. That is really economic development. The reason that fireworks are there, the reason that that's there is because it really promotes tourism. It's the best free advertising. It's worth millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars, that advertising that comes from the fireworks. You know, in the past, it was on every news show around the world, and that's what the Department of Tourism wanted to do again. We really didn't want all the extra that went along with COVID and the protests, but it's still great advertising for the state of South Dakota. And tourism is our number two or three industry, and so it really makes a difference to have that good advertising going on. So it really is an economic development. It fits the needs of the fund, and that fund's been spent on a lot of things, from buildings at Northern State College for the school for the visually impaired to equipment for training at the technical schools. So it's got a wide impact of economic development.
Are there other priorities that you bring to peer this year that you think the state legislature really needs to look at, other priorities than what we've already spoken about and some of the challenges that we know you're going to face?
Well, I think education is an ongoing challenge. I know your previous speaker talked about that. We met the requirement of the 2% inflation for next year, and it looks like we're going to be able to leave that in place. And education is always important. And we spend 49% of our general fund budget is spent on education, either K-12 or post-secondary education. So it is a big part of our budget, and it grows automatically every year under several laws that previous legislators have put into place. The other thing I think we need to look at is our state employees. Our state employees have kind of gotten the short end of the stick on pay raises for the, I think, six out of the last 10 years. And we're quite a bit under the market on what we're paying our state employees. And at some point, we're going to have a ton of retirements with all the baby boomers and stuff coming out. And we need to keep getting good quality people to work for the state of South Dakota. So we're going to have to adjust salaries at some point.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.